Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are going to be having an episode exploring the origins of the coronavirus, and a coronavirus in particular, the one you might remember, COVID-19. This is kind of slightly prompted actually by an interesting question we had from a listener. John asked, I'd be interested in hearing your comments on the origin of the pandemic. Was it a lab leak? If so, were politicians and public health officials disingenuous to initially dismiss the theory so robustly? What are your thoughts on research on microorganisms, including so-called gain of function capacity? What are the moral considerations in governments developing these capabilities? Is transparency out of the question? And, you know, we'll put our hands up here. It's not something that either of us had put huge amounts of time into studying before, but we were kind of intrigued, weren't we, by the question. And so we've been gone away and done some reading and done some research and kind of caught up on some of the really excellent investigative journalism that's been picking over this question of where did COVID come from? And we think it raises some really important questions, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've found it a fascinating dive into the available information, going back and sort of just re-understanding the sequence of events that happened in those amazing first weeks. I mean, again, it's quite hard now. We're recording this in October 23, looking back, trying to remember back to just the turn of the year in 2020.
Yeah.
And this news starting to leak out of China of a new kind of pneumonia. And we're now at a stage, it's fascinating to me that it's 3 years down the line and new information is now becoming available. As you say, Tim, mainly because of the work of investigative journalists, people have just been quietly scurrying away, reading emails and spending hours and hours finding new information. But it's certainly, I think we both feel this does give a different perspective on the events which we rather took for granted back in those first few weeks.
Yeah. Definitely. And we should say up front, obviously, neither of us, particularly me, are virologists or epidemiologists. So we are not pretending to have any massive scientific insight that isn't kind of available for those who have access to the internet. And we're not going to attempt to kind of come to a big conclusion, whether it was a lab leak or whether the virus kind of spilled over from the wild, from nature. What we do think, actually, seeing how the debate has unfolded in the last 3.5 years and some of the wider issues around this kind of field of research and science in the public eye and kind of geopolitics in the 21st century, that it raises a really important. So, we hope we'll kind of come on us over the next 30, 40 minutes on a bit of a journey talking about, the origins of the coronavirus.
Yeah, and so it goes actually all the way back to the original epidemic SARS and MERS, these epidemics of a pneumonia-like infection, viral infection, which started in the Southeast Asia and which then spread from human to human and causing significant loss of life and so on. So there was the awareness that this group of viruses was potentially deadly and could lead to a global pandemic.
Yeah, so for those who aren't familiar, SARS, sudden acute respiratory syndrome, that was another coronavirus. So again, coronavirus is a type of virus, you know, so COVID-19 is a type of coronavirus. So is the common cold. There are thousands of these coronaviruses, both in humans and also in other animals. SARS came from bats, I believe. Is that right? I think so. They did identify how it spilled over, but it was also in China in about 2003 and had a few other outbreaks later. MERS, which is Middle East respiratory syndrome. That actually first originated in Saudi Arabia and was believed to spill over from camels. And that also was very deadly, but thankfully not as infectious. And so these two epidemics didn't turn into pandemics, you know, crossing the whole globe. They were kind of localized and thankfully fizzled out after a while. But it kind of showed, as you say, that there was a risk that coronaviruses that have been circulating in other animals could at times break over the kind of species barrier and start spreading as a completely new virus among humans who would have no existing kind of protection for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I visited Hong Kong and China a year really before the pandemic broke out on a scientific visit. And I was struck by the extraordinary infection precautions that were going on in Hong Kong. And that was all apparently because of SARS, because SARS has had a very significant human impact in Hong Kong. A whole set of controls and cross-infection limits were brought in and have become embedded in a way that was completely foreign to me as a Westerner. Mm. So the memory of SARS was very strong in Hong Kong, and I think this is part of the reason why in that early phase of the pandemic, Hong Kong managed to control the spread of the virus, the new virus, extremely effectively, because they'd had this history.
So this is kind of in the first couple of decades of the 21st century. People are increasingly kind of identifying that there is a huge risk of a global pandemic coming out of an animal coronavirus. And so there is increasing amounts of money now being spent doing research in this field to better understand these viruses, how they circulate around, and what might cause one to kind of jump the species barrier and become a human virus. And that's kind of the background to what we're kind of talking about, is that there was one of many labs across the world, but there included, there was a lab in Wuhan, the Chinese city where COVID was first discovered, called the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which was one of the global leaders in doing this research on coronaviruses, particularly coronaviruses that spread around in bats. And for some various reasons, bats are kind of a large, well-known reservoir of coronaviruses. You know, the average bat will have several of them circulating, and then they constantly bump into each other inside a bat, and different species and re-evolve and blend and merge in different ways.
Yes, and what's going on in these communities of animals and viruses and so on is an absolutely classic demonstration of Darwinian evolution. I mean, again, we don't want to get into at this point about all the debates about Darwin evolution when it comes to human beings, but the proof that the combination, if you remember what Darwinian evolution depends on, is spontaneous genetic mutation and then selection by evolutionary fitness, by the ability to reproduce on into the next generation. And this is what's constantly happening. You're constantly having genetic mutations within these viruses. And then the depending on whether or not that increases their ability to survive, their genetic fitness, so-called, they will either spread or not spread. And so Darwinian evolution is constantly happening in these populations.
Yeah. And so a critical part of the story here is really the invention of kind of genetics and the idea that we can, you know, not just, you know, look down a microscope and see, oh, look, there's a virus and it, you know, that's what it looks like. But actually, from the kind of 1980s, 1990s onwards, scientists start to have the ability to begin to sequence the DNA of viruses, but also just begin to manipulate them. And over time, they kind of gain the ability to start inserting other bits of genetic code and other things at the kind of molecular level to change and almost start to create in the lab that kind of natural evolution and change that is going on outside in the wild when viruses naturally evolve as they kind of go through different species and bump into each other. People are starting to gain that ability in the lab. And this event over time it comes to be known as gain of function research.
Yeah, and interestingly, it seems as though it's always been highly controversial within the scientific community. there'd been a group of people, often I think slightly mavericks, who were saying, you know, this is a really important scientific tool. By playing around in a lab and seeing if we can make these viruses much more pathogenic, much more able to transmit between to humans and between humans, and to we're learning what is possible, what isn't possible, but we're also learning this will help us if with future natural epidemics by doing this kind of research. And of course, the counter argument is hang on a minute, you know, you are creating in a laboratory a virus which, if it happened to get out, could do devastating effects in the world. And sadly, lab leaks are very well recognized. I mean, there have been lots of well documented cases where organisms which were supposed to be safely monitored and controlled within labs have got out and caused damage in the wild. So there are various levels, and the highest level of security is often within militaries, because unfortunately, you know, military establishments are very interested in these kind of pathogenic viruses, and you know, research is going on in the UK and the US and other places, but they are in military style at very high levels of biosecurity. So it's not surprising that gain of function research is controversial, and in particular that if you are going to do gain of function research, it should only be undertaken at laboratories that have the very highest level of military grade security. But in fact, there are several institutes in China that have been doing this kind of stuff, including Wuhan. Is that right, Tim?
That's right, yeah. So this is where it starts to get kind of slightly contentious, because the WIV, the Wuhan lab we're talking about, the head of that lab has denied that it did gain of function research. But some of the journalists and others who've been digging into this have actually found evidence, including scientific papers and funding proposals, that suggest that that's not completely true. So while this kind of experimentation with a kind of genetic code of viruses has been happening for a while, a big breakthrough kind of turning point was actually in 2011, when a Dutch researcher took the H5N1 bird flu. People might remember there was a brief fear that H5N1 bird flu would become a pandemic, but thankfully it, while it is quite dangerous for humans, it doesn't spread between human to human very easily, so it kind of again fizzled out. But in 2011, this Dutch researcher, what he did is he was doing some gain of function research in H5N1, and what he did is he forced this virus to infect a community of ferrets he had in the lab and evolve, and then take that virus and go make it go back through ferrets again and again. And he did this 10 times. And after 10 rounds, these 10 rounds of evolution, he had made H5N1 become airborne. And suddenly, if this bird flu, H5N1 virus, is airborne, that probably would have been another COVID-level pandemic, because it is very dangerous to human beings and infectious. And so what he has done is effectively create a virus that didn't exist in the wild and turn it into a kind of huge bio threat to humans. And, you know, thankfully, nothing happened. It's just sitting in a test tube in a freezer somewhere in a Dutch lab. But after this, it kind of raises this huge level of controversy within the community about, is gain of function, you know, is this kind of meddling with viruses to make them more dangerous for humans really worth it? You know, because the argument goes, well, we'll, by doing this, we can see what might happen in the wild, and we might be able to kind of get ahead of the curve in developing vaccines. But we're actually the counter argument is, well, what is the point of making viruses? All it takes is for one molecule of this to slip out and infect one of your workers, who then goes home and gives it to his family, and suddenly you've got, you know, a COVID level event.
So is it true then that the US pulled funding on any gain of function?
Well, this is where it comes in with Wuhan. So what we do know is that the Wuhan lab was definitely in the process of collecting bat coronaviruses, which mostly from caves in southern China, where lots of different bat kind of populations live, and they're known to be kind of reservoirs of virus. And they were bringing them up hundreds of miles north into Wuhan. And what it turns out is that they were doing gain of function research. So in 2015, they published research where they had blended one of these bat coronaviruses with a separate mouse coronavirus. And then they'd shown that this virus could replicate in a test tube in some artificially grown human airway cells. So again, that's kind of replicating the function of what would happen if a human being breathed it in. And they were basically able to show that this new kind of hybrid virus, chimeric, they're called viruses, would have been able to spread in human airway cells. And the staggering thing about this research is that it was actually partly funded by the US government. So the US National Institutes of Health, which is their kind of big science funding body, that had had been interested in gain of function. And even though they had put a moratorium on funding while they were kind of like working out, is gain of function too dangerous? Should it be shut down? Should it be better regulated? There was a kind of 3-year pause on funding, but the American-Chinese team collaboration that was doing this research were able to kind of persuade the government that this didn't count as gain of function. And so they got hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to help fund this. And
you know, yeah. It's important just to think back to that era, because of course this is like 2015 to 2019. And in that era, scientific collaboration with China is seen as absolutely very much state of the art. You know, everybody wants to be seen to be friendly with Chinese scientists. Chinese scientists are coming to Western labs. We're collaborating together. You know, universities, Western universities are setting up branches in China. You know, the whole mood music is that close scientific collaboration with China is positive. And so it's not surprising that, you know, Western scientists are actually quite positive about working with Chinese virologists and other health scientists.
And it's fair to say that there were some Western scientists who were aware of what was going on in Wuhan and were concerned even long before COVID was a thing, you know, mostly because they weren't convinced that the Wuhan researchers had the requisite kind of biosecurity or experience to be dealing with creating such dangerous pathogens. So a lot of the Wuhan lab was only biosafety level 2, which doesn't require things like PPE or double locked doors or controlled airflow or kind of ongoing medical surveillance of research to see if any of them get sick. And so there's an interesting quote here from a microbiologist, David Relman, who spoke to the New Yorker magazine, and he said this: they were essentially playing Russian roulette with the virus that the world's expert had labeled poised for human emergence. It's a willingness to manipulate them without due concern.
So this is fascinating, isn't it? This is what is emerging. None of this story gets told in public once the COVID pandemic strikes. A completely different narrative is now. But nonetheless, it turns out, you know, there were close collaborative links, that concerns had been expressed, you know, various anxieties. Do they really know what they're doing? You know, is this sensible? And yet there are enthusiasts saying, yeah, this is the way forward, and so on. Anyway, and then the pandemic, you know, let's fast forward rapidly. The pandemic comes and immediately the questions come, well, where has this virus come from? You know, so we're now into early 2020 and questions are being asked, aren't they?
That's right. And so the first kind of report from China to the WHO, the World Health Organization, that they have this kind of novel pneumonia spreading quickly in Wuhan is on, I think it's the last day of 2019, the 31st of December. And so as we go into January, there's this kind of desperate attempt to try and sequence the DNA of the virus, to try and trace, you know, contact tracing begins to try and figure out where it goes back to. An early kind of finger is pointed at this wild food market in the center of Wuhan, which a large number of the early cases had traveled through or had bought something from. And this kind of helps nudge the conversation immediately towards what's called zoonosis or zoonotic explanation. So this is the idea that the virus, COVID-19 virus, it kind of automatically evolved among bats, then potentially went through an intermediate species that we haven't yet identified, maybe pangolins, but probably not, and then infected humans. And so it was a completely kind of natural freak evolutionary occurrence. And so people are thinking, oh, maybe this wild food market, there were lots of animals pushed up against each other in small cages, breathing their viruses over each other. Maybe this would be a good place for a kind of natural zoonotic spillover event to take place.
But already conspiracy theories, quotes, about the origin of the virus and whether this was a deliberate attempt by the Chinese government to engineer a virus that was going to decimate the West, or etc., are circulating. And so an eminent group of scientists and doctors get together, and they produce a statement which is published online on February the 18th, 2020, in The Lancet. And this says, we are public health scientists who've closely followed the emergence of the COVID, blah, blah, blah. We sign the statement in solidarity with all scientists and health professionals in China. The rapid, open and transparent sharing of data is now being threatened by rumours and misinformation around its origins. We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin. Scientists from multiple countries have published and analysed genomes of the causative agent, and they overwhelmingly conclude that this coronavirus originated in wildlife. This is further supported by a letter from the presidents of US National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine, and by the scientific communities represent. Conspiracy theories do nothing but create fear, rumours and prejudice that jeopardise our global collaboration, etc. We support the call from the Director General of the WHO to promote scientific evidence and unity over misinformation and conjecture.
Yeah, and this is a really kind of frenetic time as people in the West kind of see the freight train of COVID coming down the tracks. You know, they've seen this explosive growth in China and in Asia. You know, this is the point where China is like building entire brand new hospitals overnight to try and treat the astonishing numbers of patients. They're putting in these insane kind of draconian lockdowns. And we're starting to get this drip of cases here in the West. People fly back from China and we can see this is coming. And so there's this kind of ominous air of people are flailing about, you know, there are, and in this atmosphere, people start understandably kind of lashing out at China. And so, you know, you might recall there was a brief period where some kind of edgy internet types were calling COVID Kung Flu or the Wuhan Flu. And there's this attempt to try and kind of smear China or Asian people in general for the virus, and also a lot of the kind of right wing.
Well, Donald Trump weighs in, doesn't he? I mean, this is the ideal thing, you know. China, you know, make America great, and lo and behold, China are trying to
our great kind of geopolitical enemy is responsible for this catastrophe, and so there's a lot of kind of muttering on the internet about, was this a deliberately engineered bioweapon for China to try and, you know, ignoring the fact that it was decimating its own people, but, you know, to try and weaken Western resolve and so there's this kind of like frenzy of speculation, and into this, the kind of calm, measured scientist step with this open letter in The Lancet and say, you know, it's all conspiracy theory. Any suggestion that COVID had anything other than a completely natural evolutionary origin within in the wild is a smear, a racist, prejudiced conspiracy theory. And that has this effect of almost stamping out, or at least sorting you into two tribes. You either are with science and the decent human beings who believe it spilled over from the wild, or you're a kind of racist, right-wing kind of nut job who thinks it was made in a lab.
That's right. Well, it's not just the Lancet paper. So what we now know is that some very eminent people, including Jeremy Farrar, who is the head of the Wellcome Trust, and other eminent people all get together and they have an online conference call to discuss this. And the idea of putting a high profile paper in Nature, which will squash all these conspiracy theories, is decided. And so a group of five microbiologists specialists in the States, mainly one of them in Edinburgh, they get together and they write a paper which is published in Nature Medicine, and which, again, I've got it here, and just to quote, the conclusion says, the genomic features described here may explain in part the infectiousness and transmissibility of SARS-CoV-2, although the evidence shows that SARS-CoV-2 is not a purposefully manipulated virus, it is currently impossible to prove or disprove the other theories of its origin. However, since we've observed all these features, blah, 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 we do not believe that any type of laboratory-based scenario is plausible. And so this is then published in Nature Medicine,
One of the most prestigious academic journals out there.
That's right. And it turns out, you know, that this, as a journalist was recently wrote, "It's hard to overstate the influence of this single article, accessed almost 6 million times, cited by 5,900 other specialist papers." And so here is one of the world's leading scientific journals putting out this paper saying there's no evidence at all that this has anything to do with the laboratory. And so, of course, what happens is that all reputable journalists, all reputable scientists, they quote this paper. This is the standard. This is the standard reference on the origins of the virus. However, what has now come to light by diligent investigative journalism is a whole lot of emails and comments, online comments between the authors of this paper. And it's really very striking, because what they are saying between themselves confidentially is very different. And you know, there are some quotes. Actually, we don't know whether or not this thing came from a lab. It could have done, but then one of the authors says, you know, the expletive deleted show that would happen if anyone serious accused the Chinese of even accidental my release. My feeling is we should say, given there is no evidence of a specifically engineered virus, we cannot possibly distinguish between natural evolution and escape. So we are content with describing it to natural processes. Another one says it's a very reasonable conclusion. I hate it when politics is injected into science. So later on in this discussion they're having online, one of the guys who's writing the paper says, and who's basically leading the process, he says, it's well above my pay grade to call the shots on a final conclusion. So in other words, it seems that it's much more senior people that are ultimately deciding what the conclusion of this paper is. And the scientists who are actually writing the paper were constrained in what their final conclusion was. And so there seems to be, you know, a remarkable difference between what they actually believe, what they're talking about in private, and the impression they give in this very high profile, which is then quoted by everyone else.
Hmm. And I think this, what this tells me is that us in the kind of non-scientific public, and particularly the media, is desperate for a kind of simple story to tell. You know, is it lab leak? Is it not? Was it genetically modified? Is it not? And the scientists are painfully aware of that, and aware of the complications politically if they do kind of throw open the doors and reveal what we don't really know. And, you know, there's a lot of strange coincidences here, and it seems like a lab escape is possible, but we don't really have the data to say, you know. And that's not the kind of messy story that the world want. And so they are kind of, they almost self-censor themselves into saying it definitely didn't come from a lab, when, as you say, their own internal discussions reveal. I mean, one of them literally says here, you know, the truth is never going to come out if lab escape is the truth. It would need to be irrefutable evidence. My position is that natural evolution is entirely plausible, and we'll have to leave it at that. Lab passaging might also generate this mutation, but we have no evidence that that happened. So they're basically saying, you know, it could be either. We can't know for sure if this virus's particular characteristics were the result of natural evolution or manipulation in a lab, but it's just not, it's, you know, it's more than my job's worth to drop the political bomb of saying that. So we'll kind of self-censor and steer ourselves into a version of the truth that is cleaner and simpler to understand.
Absolutely right. And I think it's pretty clear here. This is where so often what happens is you get these cozy behind closed doors, a cozy consensus being drilled between politicians, senior scientists, and journalists. And together they agree on what the line is going to be, which is going to be most effective. And the most important thing is not to cause unrest, not to cause concern in the general public. And that famous quote, was it Queen Victoria said that she didn't mind what people did in private, as long as they didn't do it in public and frighten the horses.
Yes, exactly. And there's this attempt to kind of say the little people, the unscientifically trained people, don't need to worry their little heads about the complexities and the nuance and the subtleties here and our own internal disagreements. Let's present a united front for the good of science, you know, for the good of the public. Shall we just quickly kind of finish off the timeline before we kind of start drawing conclusions and talking about, you know, what we as Christians might do about this. So partly as a result of the Lancet open letter, but partly because of this Nature article that we've been talking about, it basically has the effect of shutting down the conversation on the origins of COVID for about 12 months. So for the rest of 2020, we're all quite distracted, obviously, by battling the virus. Scientists are focused on getting vaccines. And apart from a few notable exceptions and, you know, the cranks on the wilder west fringes of social media, everyone basically accepts this was a natural spillover event, probably at the food market, for about a year until around January 2021, the first kind of critical probing stories start to come out. There was a big piece in New York Magazine, an American publication, which kind of exposed some of the work that the Wuhan Institute of Virology had been doing. We know that they were doing gain of function research on coronaviruses in bats. And so one of the kind of critical things, I'll just go very briefly, is an event in 2012 where six miners in southern China were digging bat guano out of a cave and all fell ill with a very unusual respiratory virus. Three of them later died. A 2016 paper about this managed to identify the virus, genetically sequenced it, and found that it was, you know, they had been infected by this kind of novel bat coronavirus that they'd spent so much time with the bat feces. And this virus, called RATG13, is 96% genetically identical to COVID-19. And so this virus, RATG13, was in the files of the WIV, and in fact the head of the WIV has admitted in an interview with a Western journalist that the first thing she did when she was heard about the reports of this new kind of pneumonia style respiratory virus spreading around Wuhan was she ordered it to be genetically sequenced as quick as possible, and then she checked it against her own files to discover that it was 96% the same as this bat virus from the mining incident. And this is kind of the closest people have to a kind of smoking gun, but you can take it either way. Some people say, look, this clearly shows that they had this bat virus is 96% the same as COVID. And what they clearly were doing is they must have done some gain of function research with it, blended it with some other viruses, did some other messing around, and then it leaked out. However, the other people say, well, look, this shows that viruses almost identical to COVID naturally evolved in bats without any human intervention. So actually it's evidence that COVID could come from the natural world.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So one of the fascinating things in all this is that it's clear that the intelligence services, the US intelligence services, have been doing their own investigation and collecting evidence and so on. And they are clearly, there is concerns there that this could be a lab leak and so on. I mean, the conclusion, I think, which is many other people have come to, is that it seems actually that it's probable we will never know. It is simply impossible to know whether or not where this virus came from, and unless in the future there is some kind of smoking gun, unless a researcher at that institute in Wuhan comes out and says, actually, this is what happened, I know, I was there, and then they come and seek safety in the West and so on. Unless something like that happens, I think we will be left with this very unsatisfactory conclusion that the world will never know what the origin of the COVID pandemic was. But the story was far less cut and dried than it was presented. The way it was presented by very highly respected scientists, this kind of scientific consensus, was in fact very misleading.
And we basically lost a year. And it's almost like, you know, when you're investigating a murder, that, you know, you have this golden period when it immediately happens, and that's the best time. You know, if we had been able, as this global scientific community, to get into the ground in Wuhan in January 2020 and start doing serious contact tracing and genetic evidence, and if the WIV had opened up all its epidemiological data to the world, then it's possible we might have been able to trace it back to a specific spillover and find the interim species between bats and humans and where it has happened. Or maybe we might be able to see, do you know what, this must have, you know, infected a Wuhan lab technician by accident when they were messing around in the lab and they brought it out and took it home. But ultimately we lost that year because of both the politics kind of tainting it and the consensus to try and shut down the conversation. And it's, as you say, it's probably now, absent a kind of defector from the WIV going public, we'll never know for sure which of the two stories is true.
Yeah, but also just think about what the political implications would have been. Just suppose, you know, all that had happened and the evidence was incontrovertible. This was a human-generated virus, or a human mistake. I mean, just think what the implications would be for China and for the world. You know, think of the reparations. Think of the legal
trillions
claims,
of dollars,
the trillions
claims.
Of dollars, the millions of lives lost, the implication for every person on the planet, and it's all your fault, and we're coming to get you. Yeah. It's not going to happen, is it? Or at least you can see
China
why.
Won't allow that to happen.
You can see why the potential. For, you know, it's the kind of thing that could destabilize the entire Chinese Communist Party, isn't it? I mean, it would have been seen as
it could have been an existential kind of risk. You know, it could have generated a revolution and overthrown their you know, 70 years of power. And that is why, you know, we don't know if it was a lab leak, but what we do know is that China is working hard to prevent us from knowing. So I, you know, whether that is because they fear it was a lab leak and want to cover it up, or they know, but we do know that the Chinese Communist Party authorities in Beijing very quickly stamped down and any serious collaboration between Wuhan researchers and international bodies like the WHO. They have not shared data. They did not permit a WHO investigative team to have any real time in the lab. And so I don't know if they're trying to hide something or they just fear what they might find out, but they are very certain that if it is a lab leak, the world is not going to know.
Well, what's also fascinating to me is that there are very strong hints in all this literature that we've been reading that the senior Western politicians also don't want to know. That they felt that actually to go down the scenario that we've just mooted would be so destabilizing that it wouldn't be in their security interests. In geopolitical military interests. So actually, it's in everybody's interest that we all agree this was a natural event and that nobody's responsible. Move on here, there's nothing to see.
Except, I mean, I understand that. I think that's probably right. That's the kind of realpolitik version. But the truth is, if this was a lab leak, imagine it happened in a Western country. Imagine it was an American lab that leaked out. And let's imagine there wasn't a cover-up and that this was fully exposed. That would be devastating for America and would cause, you know, centuries long kind of ramifications in geopolitics. But it would also, I hope, cause a radical reform to gain of function research and biosecurity in virology labs, because we would say we cannot allow this to happen again. And so therefore we either kill this research dead, or we say that you can only do it if you go up to BSL-4, like you're dealing with anthrax, you know, and it's all like triple sealed and, you know, military grade security and all this stuff, because we cannot risk it happening again. But what's happened in this story is that because China won't let us know if it was a lab leak or not, you know, there, for all we know, the Wuhan lab is doing the same thing right now, again, in 2023 at BSL-2, you know, with not much more security than you get in a dental surgery, is fiddling around and creating potentially the next deadly pathogen, because no one has taken any responsibility to say if it was a lab leak, then clearly we have to completely change how we do this research.
Okay, and so we just want to reiterate that the end of the story is we simply don't know. We are not making any accusations.
No.
We don't know.
And it's probably unknowable.
And it is probably unknowable. But we are left with this really uncomfortable feeling that very high-level science, which we all rely on, can so easily become perverted by political interests. And, you know, just to step back a bit, it's interesting, isn't it, that this is a recurrent theme in our discussions is about how the public profile of science and how reliable it is and how much it is a genuine source of truth and objectivity.
Yes, because if you remember, in previous episodes recently, we talked about that interesting piece from the climate scientist who was explaining how they had had to kind of almost self-censor and simplify their own work on climate change and wildfires so that it fitted the kind of expected narrative that the editor in the journal was looking for, which was a kind of simple moral tale about how human-caused climate change was the sole reason why wildfires were getting better. And he was
getting worse.
And he was saying, actually, that is true, but there's other things involved. And then we also talked in our episode about ME and chronic fatigue syndrome, about how the scientific research into that has become incredibly contested and politicized. And, you know, patient groups and advocates are kind of trying to co-opt the process to steer it in their preferred direction. And it leaves people like me, non-scientists, wondering, can we know any truth from research? You know, can I trust what I read, and even in a peer-reviewed paper? And I have to say, when I was reading the reports around this debate about gain of function research, you know, this is taking place 2014, 15, 16, 17, so before the pandemic kicks off, taking place completely out of the public eye, taking place on, you know, international conferences and email lists between scientists and the regulators. But really, this affects everyone. This affects me. You know, whether or not scientists are allowed to artificially create viruses, which if they leaked out of the lab would be deadly and could kill tens of millions, is really a decision that I feel can't be left to the scientists alone. Because what do we know about researchers? They always want to push the envelope because they're excited by new discoveries. And there's that kind of hubristic sense that, like, trust me, I'm a scientist, I can do this. I want to know what happens if you blend a bat and a mouse coronavirus and you tweak its furin cleavage site and give it this spike protein to latch onto the ACE inhibitor. And, you know, it's all very exciting for them, but actually the decision of whether that is a safe thing or not to do can't just be the scientist's decision alone.
No, I totally agree with you. I think these things are so important that there has to be democratic accountability. And I think this kind of secret behind the doors conversation which goes on, you know, we've talked about it before, but it's a kind of they get behind closed doors, and the politicians, you know, they have their interests. They want to maintain political stability. They don't want big public debates going on, which is going to destabilize everything. The scientists are thinking about their careers and their big grant proposals and their future Nobel prizes, and they want the freedom to carry on and do the research. The commercial interests are all interested because potentially there are mega fortunes to be made, you know, if the science works, you know, so we've got shares in possible new commercial interests. And then journalists are from elite journals become co-opted in this process. You know, we need you to be giving the right message, and we all agree behind closed doors what the right message is, and then off we go. You make sure that message gets communicated. And to be honest, that stinks, doesn't it? I mean, that's where we need this kind of investigative journalism. And I'm so grateful for the fact that there are people out there who've just been scurrying away, reading thousands of emails and, you know, having things translated from the Chinese, and they've got the time and the resources and the energy to do this, and then publish. There are options for them to then publish their findings into the public domain. I mean, this is an incredibly valuable function, and I do think we as Christians need to recognize the importance of investigative journalism and the importance of finding the truth, because we believe in truth.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where we want to really land this episode, isn't it? Is about how do we as Christians, looking at this kind of morass of this maelstrom of competing opinions and culture wars and kind of scientific consensuses cooked up in behind closed doors, trying to shut down lines of inquiry, you know, how do we develop a wise discernment? You know, because some people will say, well, look, you know, you can't trust the elites. You know, they're all kind of pull the wool over your eyes, and therefore Christians need to, you know, don't be a sheep, you know. And a lot of Christians did go down that line, and sadly, you know, I saw it happen during COVID, got sucked into the kind of morass of, you know, 5G cell masks cause viruses, and, you know, lockdowns don't work.
It was the culture wars, wasn't it, really?
Yeah,
once
yeah,
this gets co-opted in the culture wars, then
it just, you know, and there are Christians who kind of got radicalized by dipping their toe into COVID conspiracy theories, and now they're all in, you know, on, you know, Bill Gates is trying to kill us, and, you know, microchips are the mark of the beast. And And I think, you know, clearly that's the opposite of Christian standing up for truth. That's kind of getting sucked into the culture war. But the opposite, the other end, is if we uncritically swallow everything we get from kind of the elite mouthpieces of Western liberal democratic culture, we would have effectively been told a just-so story. You know, COVID definitely didn't come from a lab. It's impossible. It's a racist conspiracy theory. It's definitely a natural spillover event. No conversation happened, which we now know that's not true. It might be a natural spillover event, but we do know that, like, there are significant questions to be asked, and there is evidence that suggests it could have come from the lab. You know, so where, how do we tread this fine balance where we believe in truth, we're discernment, but we don't get sucked down to either end of the extreme?
So just standing back and giving a very broad picture view, one of the interesting things historically, and this is by no means an original thought, and that is that you can divide cultures by how they rate the importance of loyalty as against the importance of truth. And that many, many non-Christian cultures fundamentally would value loyalty as a higher and more noble virtue than commitment to the truth. And therefore, you know, if your tribe has, if it's a question of do I put my tribe first or do I tell the truth, you must always put your tribe first. You put your family first, you put your nation first, you put your leaders first. Mm-hmm. And many, many cultures, that is the ultimate virtue. And interestingly, this is where Christianity at its core is very, very subversive, because the Christian faith, and you can trace it all the way back into the Old Testament, can't you? You've got to tell the truth, and the truth and speaking truth to power and standing up for truth. And that you can trace that in the early church. And then it was sort of rediscovered in the Reformation. I mean, Luther said, you know, here I stand, I can do no other. You know, that was, I have to tell the truth about the Catholic Church, however uncomfortable it is, however much it's politically unacceptable, I will tell the truth. And so that Reformation value that says, in the end, it's more important to tell the truth, even if that has devastating consequences.
Yeah. And you can see in lots of other cultures today that don't have that same Christian foundation, they don't have that same sense. You know, look at China. You know, clearly it's a totalitarian dictatorship, so telling the truth is always going to be difficult. But actually, there's lots of ordinary Chinese people who don't have a candle to hold for the CCP, but they are, it seems obvious to them that actually, even if it is true, if something is going to show their nation, their people, their tribe in a bad light, it should be suppressed. And they wouldn't see that as an act of corruption or an act of cowardice, but as the virtuous thing to do. And as you say, it's in other cultures, we see that, you know, particularly in, people talk about shame honor cultures, parts of Africa and the Middle East, where, you know, the virtuous moral thing to do is to suppress truth and kind of individual expression in the need to serve the needs of the many, of the tribe. And so we shouldn't, I think for us, of those who are kind of steeped in the kind of Western tradition, we often, it's so kind of in the water, we don't really notice this. Because even non-Christians, as you say, you know, kind of Western secular humanism probably holds a similar place on the spectrum of truth versus loyalty. And we don't really kind of appreciate, actually, that is culturally distinctive and significant.
And very valuable, you know, and this is where I think Christians do have common cause with the classic liberal position, you know, that the most important thing is to try to find the truth and to tell the truth. And that's why a free press that can just tell the truth and make sure that people know the truth has been recognized for hundreds of years as being a foundation of a democratic society. And that when you muzzle the press, you are striking at the heart of democracy.
And you know what's interesting, just briefly, is that I actually get asked this question all the time when I meet new people. It most recently happened literally last week. I met someone for the first time and they asked me what I did. They were also a Christian and I was explaining, you know, my job as a journalist, you know, and I write stories about what's going on in the church. And, you know, her first question was, you know, well, how do you strike that balance between, you know, saying, you know, we want to write things that are true, but also if I write this true thing about a scandal that happened in a church or a bad thing that a Christian did, it's going to damage the witness of the church. It's going to lower people's opinion of God and of Jesus and of Christianity in the public mind. You know, and how do you manage that? And that is, you know, and we see that all the time. There's so many Christians, despite this heritage, despite this culture, have fallen into the trap of thinking, gosh, I found out something terrible that happened within the church. God wants me not to expose that. God wants me to cover that up, because if I don't, it will damage the witness of the church. It will make people think less of Christ, and that can't be right. And ultimately, that is a kind of Christianized heresy of, you know, partisan loyalty to tribe over truth. And I always, my response is always, yes, I understand. You know, in the context, it was talking about the Soul Survivor scandal that we've been talking about, and Mike Bilavachi here in the UK, we mentioned in a previous episode, you know, it's been hugely destructive, not just to non-Christians, but the lots of Christians who came to faith through that Soul Survivor ministry. You've had to question everything now that he has been exposed to, you know, acted in a kind of coercive and abusive way. But I don't believe that God wants us to cover this up. I don't believe that we serve God's purposes and his kingdom by choosing loyalty to tribe over truth.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there has been, or there is, a sea change in Christian culture that is increasingly recognizing that because of the abuse scandals. You know, if you'd gone back 30 years, I think there were many senior Christians, very well educated and mature, wise Christians, who would have said, actually, it is better to keep it all quiet. Ultimately, that's more in the interest of the gospel. And I think we have learnt, most people have learnt painfully, that this is just wrong. This is in the end, our commitment to truth, to transparency, to be honesty, to integrity must outweigh all these other concerns about the optics and about tribal loyalties and impressions given in the end. And you know, this does ultimately come back to the nature of the God himself, because when God is a God of truth, who, when he says something, it can be relied on. That is the essence of his nature. And for his people to become then dissembling, concealing, twisting, it is a nonsense. It cannot be right.
And we've been going through Ephesians in our church recently, and there's a wonderful passage where Paul is talking about how, you know, once you were in darkness, but now you have become children of light. You know, all things that are in the dark will be brought into the light. So we have to live in the light. And, you know, I fundamentally believe it's not just some out of some abstract love for truth that we do this, but actually it's good for the church. You know, it might seem hard to believe right now when there's thousands of people angry at Soul Survivor and Mike Bilavachi for harming them and harming the gospel. But actually, in the long run, I do believe that people will heal faster and the church will become more like the church it's supposed to be if things that are in the darkness are brought into the light. You know, that short-term crisis and optic PR problem pales into insignificance in comparison with actually the good that shining God's light on these dark things will have. So, yeah, that's the kind of core premise behind why I do what I do, even because a lot of the time the stories I write are bad news stories, you know. They're not just about what wonderful things the church is doing, but they're also about the awful things the church is doing and the terrible mistakes that Christians have made and the failures. So it's something I think about quite a lot.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm afraid we're agreed here. We've had one of the comments we had is, why don't you have more disagreements? You know, your problem in your podcast is that you agree too much.
All right. I'm going to quickly leave and come back again, seeing if that fixes it.
Hi.
I'm back.
Yeah, that's fixed it.
Did you hear me all the way through, or did I cut out?
No, okay. I'm pretty sure it's recorded. So I'm just going to close. We're finishing now.
Yeah, we're finished now. Yeah.
So basically, we agree, Tim. But you know, we've had this comment, haven't we, from one of the listeners, that your problem is that you agree too much between us, and you need people who disagree with you. And so I think we've agreed together that surprise, surprise, truth is important. Investigative journalism is important. Good science is important.
Yeah, no one could have predicted that, could they?
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Who would have thought it?
Or maybe just we're right on everything, Dan, and that's why we
agree. Of course, that is the point. I mean, that's why we do the podcast, because since we are basically right on everything.
Well, thank you everyone for coming to gather around the pulpit and listen to this week's preach from Tim and John Wyatt. I hope it wasn't too predictable. We'll try and disagree more on future podcasts. We actually have got some ideas in the pipeline where we do actually have kind of different takes on issues, I think. So hopefully we'll be a bit more spiky and contentious in future. And we've got some plans to have some interesting guests come on as well to hear their perspectives. So thanks everyone for listening. I hope that was interesting. We'll pop some links from some of the research and the excellent investigative journalism that we relied on in the podcast notes. So if you want to find out a bit more, we could only really scratch the surface about this roiling debate about the origins of COVID. So if you want to find out more about that, please do click through some of those links. There's lots more to read on Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, particularly lots of material produced during the pandemic around COVID and the vaccines and how we can navigate that wisely as Christians, if you're not too traumatized to dig back through that recent history. And as always, please do get in touch with us. We love to hear your questions. This whole episode was prompted by a really fascinating question out of the blue from a listener. So thank you to John who sent that in. But also, if you have any other questions, do get in touch with us. You can email us molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. Should stress that's premier the British way. I've realized Americans have an E on the end, so premier.org.uk. We'll be back with another episode next week, but until then, bye bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Thank you.